So again, I want to just say that I'll tell you a personal story about Chico. But before I do that, I just want to say that he's absolutely qualified to be here. He is a recovering addict, and so I will just tell you that in my story, we went to two of the most well-paid counselors in Dallas. I can assure you. Because I, as like any good enabler, I tried to throw money at it. And so I did that for a while, and it was very interesting. When Hunter was smoking pot 10 times a day, I had two different counselors tell me that he was basically a good kid. He didn't have an addiction problem, and he just needed mentoring. And so we went down a path, and it led me to some really meet some great people, but I didn't get it. And so Chico discovered that he was an addict in about 5 minutes. And so it just takes one to know one. And so so Chico's been sober since August of 89. He has got his counseling degree from DTS. He had an undergraduate at SMU. He has been in counseling and addiction, doing interventions in counseling and drug addiction since 1994. He opened up Gaston House and sold that just recently. And he's going to tell you about Casa Colina. It's a new facility that he owns and is just south of town here, and I was desperately trying to get out there and take a look at it because, you know, I met with somebody else last week. We're always trying to help you in many ways to process what are the options out there for recovery and things like that. If you're here tonight and you don't have an addict, you're not that's not struggling with heroin or cocaine or whatever, we're going to talk about other issues and same-sex stuff. We're going to talk about really things you want to talk about. I think we've got some questions that are burning, but you all have cards in front of you. So what I'd like for you to do is if along the way, if you have a question or two, you can write that down and just pass that down maybe. And then we're going to have some people coming down the aisles. If you'll just put those out there on the corner, keep them, show they're written on the upside, and we'll just come by and collect those and we'll try to process it. If we don't get all your questions, we'll keep those, and if you want to put your name on it, we'll try to follow up with you, even if we don't get to the question tonight. If you don't put your name on it, then just tell your leader you got a question, right? And we'll try to. That's what we do every week. So anyway, that's what we're going to do. But I would just tell you that I'll just tell you one more story that about Chico, and I mentioned it last week. But right when this first started. I think I told him this story last week, and he doesn't remember it. I don't blame him for that because I have a lot of patients to do the same thing to me. But I'll never forget it. I came in dressed somewhat like this after a day of seeing patients in the office and running late as always. And this whole thing about we just shipped my son off to Wilderness Treatment Center at his recommendation. I'd never met him, and so we made the appointment, and my wife was there and frustrated that I was late, and I came in, and again, she didn't understand how big a deal I was, and so I was trying to tell her that, and so I came in, and in my usual manipulative behavior, I'd heard a lot of good things about him, so I tried to make sure Chico knew I was a good guy and was listening and whatever, and then I kind of loosened my tie, and I said, you know, after the end of our conversation, I said, so I get this, you know, and I hear what you're saying, and it makes a lot of sense. I said, but just in general, and I don't mean to nail you down about this, you know, but in general, this whole addiction thing, recovery thing, about how long does that take to kind of run its course? And that's a true story. I actually said that. And he said, the rest of your life. And I'll never forget that moment, right, where you were standing, like when we invaded Iraq, when Kennedy got shot, and when it was going to be the rest of my life, I remember it. So he has been really straightforward with us. We haven't gone a lot, but when we've gone when we've been desperate to see a reasonable voice, one that doesn't call us back to him, but calls us to, he's a Christian counselor. He points us in really frank, really practical wisdom that you can take home and you can use and a way to live your life out. So I'm really excited to have Chico. I'm going to have him come up and talk and give him a welcome, and then we'll have some question and answers after this. Okay. Okay. Oh, I'm going to put this on you.
That would be better because
yeah.
ADD.
Yeah, good. Oh, you know what? I'm going to give you this. Yep. Here, tell you what we're doing. This is, we're recording this, so I'm going to have you do that. I'm going to give you both of these.
All right.
Put that on here, and I'll take the mic.
I better just take my glasses off.
We're a well-oiled machine here. Get you all wired up.
All right. Thank y'all. Hi, my name is Chico West. And thank you, Jay and Jenny. It was great. I'm really honored to come here and share this, because I remember when Jay and Jenny were talking about doing this ministry here, you know, from some times we spent together. And man, I've been blown away how it's grown and what it's grown into. And then Larry Miller and I are good buddies as well. And I love seeing Larry get involved in this, and him and Gwen, and just how it's exploded. It's a cool deal. And I will tell you, I hope to be done, you know, no later than 7:45, because the Spurs are playing tonight, and I want vengeance. You know, I hate to say that, but I was bummed when Kawhi got hurt, and I'm kind of holding Zaza accountable, if any of y'all saw that. I agree with Pop. But a couple things. When I was talking to Jay last week, I do want to kind of focus on addiction, primary addiction with chemicals. You know, we have an epidemic going on with opiates, and 91 people are dying a day from opiate addiction. It's more than automobile accidents and firearms combined. Yesterday, I found out a man I know pretty well, his son died of opiate addiction in February, and his oldest son died of it two nights ago. You know, and, you know, I called him and I talked to him, we're in a church building, but all he could say was, you know, the F word. And he loves the Lord. And I go, I told him that makes sense. I go, I don't know what to tell you. But I do want to talk about not just, you know, the opiate addiction, but I want to talk about if you are struggling, if you do have a child, if you do have a family member that's struggling with addiction, man, how do you find the right facility? How do you find the facility that, you know, will help your kid? What's going on in my field is crazy. There is a lot of private equity coming all over, you know, my field. You know, a lot of money is being poured into addiction. And, you know, being an owner of a private facility, that's not all bad. You know, some private equity can do some good things, but if you're a family member and you're talking to a call center and you wanted to talk to the actual treatment center, you don't know that. You know, you're calling down to a facility because you saw it online or someone told you about it. Those are the questions that you need to know to ask. Is this a call center, and where are you located? You know, what is your facility? Can I talk to someone actually there that is going to, you know, spend time with my son or daughter? You know, can you give me some references to other people? You know, ask them the question how they define success. You know, I don't think that's a bad question. You know, do they follow up on the people that have come through their program? How often do they follow up with them? But those are the things that you have to be aware of, because right now with the internet, there is so much out there, and people, and the pictures are great, and, you know, the stuff is good. And I'm not saying they're all bad, the private equity or any of that kind of stuff, but a lot of times when you're calling and you're desperate, you're talking to someone that might be three states away, and you're not talking to the facility. You know, me personally, if my son, I have boys, so I'm not going to talk about daughters, but if my boys were struggling with addiction, the questions I would want to know, you know, how active are they in the 12 steps of recovery? Because if you look at the 12 steps, it's real, I believe, real simple. Alcoholics Anonymous is if I was to ask someone, real simple, it's the simple truth about Alcoholics Anonymous is just about a relationship with God. Now, there's a lot of other things that go along with it, and doing a searching and fearless moral inventory, looking at your character defects, your shortcomings, and stuff like that. But it's about a relationship with God. You know, it's about recognizing that you aren't God and that you need to get out of the way and be of service to others. You know, and a lot of programs out there will say, hey, we're about the 12 steps. But what do they mean they're about the 12 steps? I like what Jay said. Hey, Chico's recovering. I'm not recovering. I'm recovered. How come I say recovered? Because I look at the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's in the very beginning of it, in the preamble, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You know, we wrote this book to show others how we have recovered. Does that mean I'm cured? No. I am not cured. Because if you go on and you look at the 10th step and continue to take a personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admit it. You know, what later on, I believe it says on page 85, it goes, you know, I have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. You know, okay, can I call you out and use you as an example? Okay, my buddy Ben's here tonight. And it is by God's grace. Ben and I went to the same treatment center in 1989. We were in the same halfway house in 1989. Ben's a couple years older than me from my hometown. And I shared this today with my staff. He's on my staff now, and I'm excited. Ben does not have 27 years of continuous sobriety. It's God's grace. I've just been doing things. It doesn't make me better than or any less than. You know, he's had some relapses. We went to this same place, same program, and how come I'm still sober today? You know, I've done some things. You know, but ultimately, I would say it's my relationship with the Lord. Ben loves Jesus today. But he, you know, when we were on break from Halfway House, can I share that story too? I told him that he was gonna have to speak for a minute, but really I was just gonna use him as an example. But the deal with Ben is I struggled in my relationship with my parents, but for some reason, man, I had a spiritual awakening 90 days sober. And God grabbed a hold of me at that moment. You know, fast forward about 30 days after that 90 days, we're in San Antonio, you know, home from Halfway House. And, you know, Ben always jokes. I don't remember this, just like I didn't remember telling Jay that. But he said, my mom, we were going back to Atlanta. My mom goes, let's lay hands on Ben. And we laid hands on Ben. I don't remember that, but, you know, that's something that happened. But it's really Alcoholics Anonymous and looking at different programs is you got to look at, are they about the book? Are they about the solution? If you're looking at treatment centers, are they doing those things? Is it just, you know, some people, 30 days might, you know, can work and will work. But a lot of times this addiction has taken them down a road for a long time, and 30 days is just the beginning. Their heads are just beginning to get cleared up. But we've gotten sucked in to this mindset that, hey, 30 days works. You know, after a few weeks of recovery and making right choices, the most common thing is, hey, they're ready, they're cured. But they aren't. They have a daily reprieve. What is their aftercare plan? You know, those are some of the questions you need to ask. You know, I'm not a believer, but I do think it helps having other people that are recovered in the program if you're dealing with addiction. But you can also have some really good people that understand the steps and that have worked the steps themselves. And so those are the other questions, you know, to ask. How active are you, are your staff members in their own recovery? You know, what are they doing to take care of themselves? Because just helping others, you know, for a paid job, that doesn't make you all right. You know, it's about are your other staff members getting out and being of service to others as well? You know, that's the thing that really gets in the way. I was thinking of some other things to share, but I just want to share my conversation that happened on the way over here. A woman from my church called, the pastor and one of the Sunday school teachers had called me about this family back in March. And I made some suggestions. And since March, this is a 45-year-old man with 3 kids and his wife, and his addiction has taken over. And I just asked, How many different people are you going to continue to go down and ask for help? Now, I believe in community. I believe in seeking out others. But then you need someone, if someone is struggling, to really steer the ship. Because everybody will have different opinions. And I challenge this woman in my church. I go, I think all those people that you mentioned have great intentions for your family. But you're struggling going, okay, something needs to change. Your kids, you know, these teenage kids are saying something needs to change with dad, yet you keep doing the same thing over and over. You know, and y'all know that definition. It's that insanity. You know, and so, you know, I challenged her. I go, so when are you going to get out and begin to make decisions, you know, that need to take care of yourself and your kids? Or are you going to continue to jump through hoops? Your husband might go to treatment or might not. But you calling this person, this person, this person, this person, and not changing is repeating the process over and over again. You know, and that's the deal that I love about y'all's ministry here, because what y'all are doing is going, okay, how do I need to change before I can help, you know, my loved one? You know, so another thing about kind of to wrap up, because I know that Jay really wants to ask me questions up here. But the other thing that I want to say is how when you're looking at programs, how active are the family program? You know, what do you do with us as the family members? You know, how long is your family program? You know, what are you going to be, you know, what are you going to be challenging me to do? But those are the things that you need to look for and ask when vetting a program. You know, Jay's a doctor, and, you know, as a doctor, he has a lot of competition in what he does in this town, I believe. Is that correct? Yeah. And I thought that was kind of funny. But, I mean, if people are going to get his help for plastic surgery, they're going to probably interview a couple different plastic surgeons. Why not interview several different programs? I've been a believer. I think Jay was gracious. Yes, I started a 90-day treatment program. Yes, it's all male. You know, I really am. I did not come here to talk about Casa Colina. I believe in it. And, you know, I'll leave some cards up here, but I really want to help families. I'm only 23 beds. There is a lot of people that need treatment. I believe if I stay consistent and have integrity, you know, the doors will open. I do need to get out there and do some work, but I'm not up here to talk about Casa Colina. I'm up here because there's daughters, there's wives, you know, there's people that are not appropriate. The lady that I talked to, I have a 56-year-old man down to a 20-year-old in my program right now. But that 45-year-old, you know, wife that I was talking to, I her husband's not appropriate for my program. I referred her on. You know, I want y'all to know you have to find the programs that are more about helping the individual than helping their pocketbook. And I'm passionate about that, you know, these days. You know, there's programs that don't cost any money that people have changed that are out here. You know, and they're untapped, you know, little diamonds. There's, you know, Men of Nehemiah. You know, there's ARM. You know, there's the 24-hour club when it reopens. You know, there's Nexus. Those are things that people don't even realize that are right here in our city. You know, and those things, people's lives are changing because they're asking for help. They're taking direction. They're humbling themselves. And you know, that's the thing that's occurring. That, you know, Jay shared with me. People's lives are changing here, and so did Larry, about because y'all are getting out of the way and going, okay, what part am I playing in this? The crazy thing, my life radically changed in the last year. I owned it. I kind of lost my baby, Gaston House. I started it, you know, and now I have this new program. But what I've recognized in the last year is how my codependency or my need to control things has gotten in the way. And I've had to recognize, okay, man, I got to expose my stuff and continue to work on myself, or I'm not going to be effective any other way. But I told Jay last week, I just wanted to talk about how, when you're looking and when you see your kids, it's prodigal, so I can stick with kids, you know, or you get a call, man, how to vet the programs that are out there and what to look for and what to ask. And so I'll kind of leave it at that and let Jay come up and ask me questions.
So Chico, expand a little bit. One of the questions we had from the leaders and we've had so far is, I hope there's a little paper you're sitting on with my questions on it. No, it's down here. Sorry. So anyway, yeah, have a seat. So would you expand a little bit on the some of the free treatment options? Because when people don't have money, there's some options out there. I know Kay Miller, one of our leaders, her son got involved in Men of Nehemiah. I've been down there. Jenny and I just fell in love with it. It's a fantastic place. And I'm behind it because of, you know, I'd be behind something you're doing because I know you and I know your character and I know Lewis and how he's
awesome.
You can trust your prodigals with Lewis. And so we have, I'm going to let him expand on that because I just know about Men of Nehemiah. I don't know exactly what Nexus is and some of those, but some of the people here don't have money. They're looking for those kind of things. Could you just expand for a couple of minutes on those places?
Yeah, well, Men of Nehemiah, right down the street from Men of Nehemiah, and I saw Kay. I didn't want to expose that, Kay. Aren't you back there? I love Kay Miller. She's a
rock
star. We
all do. You can't have her.
Yes. You know, Men of Nehemiah, just down the road from Men of Nehemiah, is called ARM and WARM, Adult Rehabilitation Ministry, and, you know, Women Adult Rehabilitation Ministry. And it's actually closer to 35, just down 8th Street. And it's, you know, it's a different model. I love Men of Nehemiah. Men of Nehemiah's model works well for a lot of men. You know, ARM's model and WARM's model is more real. It's not in, you know, getting up and doing calisthenics and stuff like that. It's working with people the same thing, but they're going to have a little counseling, you know, and it's, you know, the cost is minimal, but there's a lot of people that support it. And so if you don't have the money, they're really trying to get people back on their feet. And in that little area, it's right next to Golden Gate Baptist Church. And so it's plugged in with them. And it's like, I think $13, you know, it's $330 a month. But if you can't afford that, people do sponsor guys there. But then people stay there for 4 to 6 months, you know, sometimes longer. And, you know, they have a full kitchen and they do, you know, they do big book studies. And they, you know, they're required to go to the church service with Golden Gate. And, you know, they do have Bible studies, but then they transition them out and help them find jobs. And they have little houses right there. Nexus is really primarily an all women's facility, and it's out I-30 by Mountain View College, Eastfield, yeah. Eastfield, and it has, the great thing about Nexus, it's had a lot of funding from people that have money and they can give, but it's primarily for, I think Watermark for a while would go do haircuts and beauty for the women there, and they work with women that have kids and stuff like that, and they have a primary and then outpatient program. And then the 24-hour club, what I love, which has been around for, you know, since 1968, I've gone to meetings there for a long time. They just tore it down and they're rebuilding it. But it's a place that would have three AA 12-step meetings a day. But you could go if you're coming off the street and pay $10 a day to live there. And then if you're doing well and you're making some money, you can pay $14 a day and move upstairs and you're not sleeping on a mat downstairs where the meeting is. But it's really trying to empower them. So there's a lot of options out there that people don't realize, that people's lives are really changing that are that way. And sometimes it might be the best thing for, if you do have money, that might be the best thing for your child to see where their addiction's heading. You know, is to point that out. Salvation Army, a lot of people have gotten sober through Salvation Army. Dallas Life, a lot of people have gone there and gotten sober as well. And so those places might be the best place for your child, your loved one, instead of, you know, giving them the treatment. But sometimes treatment is a real good option because there might be some trauma issues going on. There might be some other dual diagnosis issues that a lot of those programs just don't have the funding to provide. And don't have that structure. And sometimes your kids might not make it. They might be impulsive and take their life, you know, if you do that. So it's that balance. And y'all are in that place of balance.
Right. So, we could go to a thousand different directions. But why don't you, one of the things that we struggle with a lot here is you just mentioned it, so I'll just take that key. How do you process the dual diagnosis? I had somebody just hand me something that ties in with that about how you encourage your adult child to get help for depression. They take their meds, but they won't see a counselor. And I always, Chico, what I always say is a physician who knows that there are chemical imbalances, and you want to prioritize that to make sure you're not missing a basic thing. But once that happens, you know, my view is, I don't know of any situation, whether you're training a dog or you have a kid with bipolar or whether you have the smartest person in the world that went to Harvard, where the principles of the Bible and discipline and boundaries and consequences don't enhance that. Are we on track there with that? And can you comment on the complexity of dual diagnosis or make any comments about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that person's talking about someone with dual diagnosis that also has, you know, addiction issues. Let's just stick with just dual diagnosis,
right?
You know, and they're not taking their meds. Okay. Let's say they're diabetic and they love eating sugar all the time, and they're all of a sudden they're ending up in the hospital. You know what? You know what? How do you respond to that? You know, what if it's your husband sitting in the room right next to you and he's not taking his blood pressure medicine? You know, the more you get in there and tell him what to do, if you're a husband, and you know, how often does that happen? The more you get in there and try to control the situation. Now, what I encourage families to do and others is, how is it affecting you personally? You know, what's going on with you when your son, when your daughter doesn't take your meds? Let them know, you know, your feelings. You know, I'm big on that, and Jay's seen that, and Larry's seen that. Is I have a feelings board in there. They're just feelings. But, man, that's what stems a lot of our conversations. Kay knows that as well. Sorry, Kay, I just exposed that. But that's the deal, is do you get in there? Are you fearful? You know, are you feeling lonely when they act like everything's going all right and they're just, you know, blowing smoke up your butt? You know, what do you tend to do? And then how do you tend to get in there and control that? You know, so you need to share your own experience when talking about that. When you're dealing with dual diagnosis, when addiction occurs, it's hard to get a good read if someone's getting stoned all the time, if they're depressed or if they're anxious. You know, if they're taking a bunch of Xanax and they're nodding off or shooting heroin, you know, or if they're in the throes of addiction and they're just lying, you're going to be anxious. You're going to be depressed. You know, so I'm not sure it's actual dual diagnosis until we get some time away from the chemicals they've been abusing before you can get an accurate read on that. And that's why you want to make sure they get some time away if there's addiction issues, if they're covering that up. Because anxiety, depression are for sure happening if they're addicts, because they're probably lying. They're probably covering it up. But then there's people that are truly dual diagnosis. You know, but what I love is what I think it goes right along with scripture. The big book talks about in chapter 5, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. The two key little phrases right there are there's the cannots and there's the will nots. Most addicts are will nots. The cannots, they are such unfortunate. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. You know, the cannots are the ones that are the dual disorders. Most people are the will nots. You know, so the cannots can recover if they have the capacity to be honest and probably get some meds and probably change up their diet and probably exercise. So there's a lot of that going on. Does that help?
Well, it does, but in terms of the practical nature of some of the things that we're talking about here, in terms of someone has a dual diagnosis, I just want to try to summarize, in other words, what you would take home from that. Help me.
Yeah.
You know, I love him because he won't let me get away with anything if I say something wrong, and I want the truth here. So a principle that you could have if you have a dual diagnosis kid, it's just a chaotic formula. And what we try to do here is do exactly what you said. How does this affect you? Because really this walk, the only thing you can control is the task that God has before you. So how do you eliminate the chaos to do the task you are while loving your kid well? So it gets confusing. So one of the things I heard you say, Chico, was let's get rid of the addiction first, whether it's, you know, drug testing, get them in a facility, get the drugs out of it, because it's impossible to, a lot of the drugs cause what looks like schizophrenia, bipolar, whatever. Get all of that out of the way. Also, don't neglect the fact that if you have medical advice that there is some chemical imbalance. I got to tell you, they've heard me say this. I'm a physician, but I trust very few psychiatrists. It's just a quagmire. So the first thing you do is you get the drugs out of the way. The second thing you do is you go to some reputable people you can trust, and you process this all together, because there's discipline, there's medications, and I guess one of the things that you agree with that so far. So what do you do when someone doesn't take their meds? He said, what do you do about that? The point is, what if you get hit by a bus? I mean, they've got to have some consequences, and it seems harsh sometimes if they don't take their meds, but if you rescue them and you get hit by a bus, they're going to have to face that one day. So we tell them that sometimes you can't make them take their meds. I don't know how that's possible. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, especially when you're dealing with adult children. You know, and when you have adult children not taking their meds and you get in there, here's the deal is they could not even be addicts and they could still cheek their meds. You know, so you don't even know if they're taking their meds. You know, and so all of a sudden you're battling something that's going to create more anxiety or depression. That mom's on my butt, that dad's on my butt, you know, those kind of things. You got to, even if they're not addicts, you got to separate, you know, and get a good picture. Because I agree with him, you know, my struggle is, and I like you, Jay, but, you know, I think part of the addiction problem is doctors. You know, it is, you know, when the, you know, Jayco changed, you know, and added a fifth vital sign. You know, up until 2001, there were four vital signs. Now we've added a fifth one, and that's, you know, that's part of the problem, too. You know what
explain
the fifth
it.
One is?
No, explain that.
You know what the four vital signs are if someone comes in, you know, heart rate, respiratory rate, you know, breathing and blood pressure and temperature. The fifth one they added was pain. You know, and you go in and, you know, some of you that are older and stuff like that, that you never saw the pain chart back in the 80s, 90s or 70s. We added that. And it was from the VA hospital because the vets were coming in. And so that is subjective. That is not, you know, just concrete like the other four vital signs. You know, your temperature is your temperature. Your heart rate's your heart rate. You know, pain is, you know, if I ask Jay, what number are you on the pain scale? And so we just pump meds, you know, instead of stepping back. So there are people that are dual diagnosis, and I'm a firm believer in that. But you got to step back and go, okay, what's really going on with the person? You know, and not get in there and try to fix them, rescue them, or control them. And the more you do that, that's going to create depression. So you become part of the problem instead of part of the solution. And you have to allow them to have their consequences.
So I think the things we do in Prodigal, I've always said this, is that the principles we've taught in terms of how you handle boundaries and consequences and laying your Isaac down and doing those things and how do you handle anger and forgiveness and where do you find your hope and all that, it's just parenting, right? It's just parenting. And it just becomes more dramatic when you have a prodigal. And you have to, then the trust comes in. I mean, it's do you trust God with your child, right? And then when you get dual diagnosis, it's even more. Because when you don't have a prodigal, it's easier because you think they're going to do it. And then when you let go, when you have a prodigal that's doing heroin, it's harder. Then you have one that's schizophrenic. And, I mean, the point is that at some point you're going to have to let go because you can't control it, and it just makes it harder, but the answers are the same. I mean, I think. So I think we're hearing the same thing, so that's validating. One of the things I wanted to ask.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Becky, who came up, I like what she said. Man, we always focus on your kid. Y'all are here because your kids are probably struggling. Okay.
Sometimes spouses.
Or their spouses or, you know, or whatever. Sometimes you need to hear like Becky's, you know, stuff too, that people can go through that prodigal, go, you know, get their parents' wealth, go squander it on women and prostitutes and drugs and alcohol, but then they can come back out of it. You know, and so we sometimes need to lift that up too, that people can come out of it. And it's sometimes not even on Becky's deal. It's just, you know, God grabbed a hold of them. So sometimes we need to rejoice that. I just thought that was
random
thought.
No, it's not a random thought. In fact, it ties in with a couple of things I want to ask, and I don't know which way to go, but I'm going to ask this. So this is a personal question. I think it applies to you, so I feel obligated. Plus, I'm running it, so I'm going to ask the question. So the point is, so I came and watched the ASK documentary. And the thing that I remember, and Stephen, Lisa, and I watched it as well, some of our leaders. And so I was in the throes of shortly after I met with you about my son. And we were trying to talk with him about, and I'm going to tell you, we went with our leadership and their very wise counsel. So I've taken away everything from him financially, right? But he's still playing the game, not telling the truth, don't know where he is. And so when the thing that to me that's the hardest thing is I've done this ministry for 7 years, lying has gone to the top of my list because you can't have a relationship if you have untruth. If you're struggling and you're struggling well and you're honest about it, we can deal with that all day long. But when you're lying, and so we got to a point where I just didn't believe anything he said and he was just untrustworthy. So I went to Chico, what does this look to engage at this point? In other words, because I had people in recovery that said, you're still giving him something. You're giving him a relationship, and he loves that. It's his family. He's adopted. And so I'm going, wow, that seems harsh. And so Jenny and I struggle with, so what does Thanksgiving look like? I mean, you come over and you have a meal, and then you go home and to watch him walk out the door. And I was okay with that, but then it got to the point where you don't even have a meal with him. And so that fine line, when I saw ASK documentary, I saw these kids that got well. And they had a pretty uniform story that they somehow realized their parents loved them. You know, the one where he brought the groceries, stepping over bodies on the floor from the party the night before and set groceries on the table and walked out. And the kid said, I remember that and my parents love me. So what do I do? After I leave that documentary, I call my son. and it leads on a path to just total manipulation and getting hammered again, right? So my point is, I still struggle with that. So can you comment on how we battle that line between engagement, so they know we love them, and not enabling, and just the relationship of what does Christmas and Thanksgiving look, and how do you know when they've come home? I mean, that's a big statement, but can you comment on that a little bit? In 2 minutes?
Yes. Yeah. How come you need Hunter to know you love him? Haven't you given him that already?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And so really it's more about you wanting to make sure he knows.
Yeah.
You know, Hunter already knows he loves you. You know, and so
it knows I love him.
Yeah, and knows you love him. You know, and it goes both ways. And so it is that fine line right there. If, you know, were you doing it to take care of yourself after leaving that film? And if you are, check your motives. That's where I'm always challenging people. Check your motives. Okay, if your motives are good, you know, then you don't need to worry. You know, show up there. You know, it's like this. I'll use it from an alcoholic perspective. You know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, on the big, we were talking about this today at Casa Kalina. On page 101, it says, you know, to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. We have tried those methods, and the result is a bigger explosion. So don't avoid where there is alcohol, bars, nightclubs, weddings, plain old ordinary whoopee parties. You know, and so that a lot of people say, oh, you got to avoid that. That's not till step 12. That's where it comes up. I think that can apply to the family member because he's the alcohol to you. You know, don't avoid him if you have a legitimate reason for doing that. You know, but if you're on shaky ground, it's better for you to go work with another prodigal family.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I guess my point is, and I see people nodding their heads saying, I want to know that answer. And so, my point was, is I really...
wanted to tell him you loved him.
I really feel honest that his outcome doesn't define me anymore. It used to.
Yeah.
Right? It did. But I just, after that film, I just wanted to say, I just want to make sure when I have an opportunity to put those groceries out there, he knows that that's still there if he ever doubts it. And I think, and then Jenny would tell you, he already knows that.
Yeah.
And so we have that discussion, and so you just kind of struggle with that. And I guess you process it in community. That's what we tried to do. And as long as
and I'm not sure there it's
is a
you
right
know
or wrong answer.
Right or wrong answer. It you know it depends. If you're getting in there and you know buying them groceries, bailing them out of jail, you know fixing the tickets, doing all that stuff, then
okay, it's a different deal.
You're not doing any of those things, and I know that, Jay. And so the deal is, hey, if you share that, then be prepared after you tell him and you talk to him on the phone that, you know, if he's not in that healthy place, he's going to get right back into manipulation.
Yeah.
And that's what you got to prepare yourself for.
And we got out of it as soon as we saw that.
And so, as soon as you see that, then you've done the right thing.
Okay. So what about there's a book called Primal Wound, you know, about adoption and you know, and there's a lot of kids, as you know, adoption, not every kid that gets adopted goes down the bad path, but there's a lot of people that have gone down an addiction path that are adopted. So what they are throwing out at us from time to time is that when they get smart enough, you know, you've abandoned me, you know, they feel, you know, there's attachment issue, there's identity. I don't see biblically how we change our principles just because they're adopted. Or are there things like this book would suggest that you have to treat them differently, be more sensitive to the abandonment issues and the isolation issues? And certainly it's in our family, and we have a lot of people out there. Is there any guidelines about, is adoption really any differently, or are those steps still the same?
Well, how I look at adoption, I mean, if we're believers, we're all adopted. You know, there is only one true son, you know, and that we, with him getting on the cross and dying there, we accepting that and falling on our knees, we become God's adopted children. You know, so we can connect with them on that level, you know, that I'm still loved incredibly, even though I'm not Jesus. You know, and I mean, that's how, you know, I'm not adopted, but yet I am adopted.
Right.
Yeah, my dad died. I'm adopted with Christ, but my dad died in 79. My mom remarried, and, you know, my father from, you know, 1980 until, you know, be 3 years in October. He was my father and my best man, and he adopted us. And so, you know, people look at me, well, you weren't adopted, you know, and you at least knew your dad. Yes, that's true.
But if they say, if they use an excuse to me, the abandonment, I want to be sensitive to that because I don't know what it's like to be
abandoned.
So I do want to be sensitive to that. But when you, as all the parents in this room, when you love your kid incredibly and you and they tell you're adopted, I mean, you're abandoned, to me, you know, I just, you know, as you can tell, Chico will straighten me out if I'm wrong. But to me, that's manipulation. But I don't want to be insensitive because the book would tell me I'm being insensitive and I don't understand that. So I just want to do things right. But to me, I just, when I haven't ever abandoned him, give him everything you wanted to, give him every opportunity, tell him you love him all the time, show him you love him, model it all. If it's abandonment, I don't know that I can address that. And God's going to have to solve that issue.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I don't know if you can address it, if I can address it, and stuff like that. And, you know, it's also a book. I've always wanted to write a book. And, you know, I could put that word in there. And you don't know my, you know, complete thinking about it being insensitive. I don't know. It might, you know, from what that author's saying about it's insensitive, it might be from his perspective. You know, and so in the context that he's coming from.
Right.
So I don't know, you know, there might be some truth. We might be being insensitive.
Right.
You know, but we might not.
Right.
And so that's, you know, God knows your heart. And so it's checking your heart. And if he is manipulating, you've raised the kid. Even though your wife, you know, Jenny didn't birth him, you know, you've raised him. You've nurtured him.
Right.
And you know that manipulation.
Right.
And so go with your gut.
Okay. With regard to medical, somebody had a question about the differences in
medical marijuana.
No. Yeah. Isn't it crazy that when, you know, I, as a doctor, I get we'll go ahead and address that for a second, but isn't it amazing that this now, because medical marijuana and marijuana is more ubiquitous, now we can do better studies medically. And in the last 3 weeks, I've gotten good scientific, reputable articles that show there's a higher rate of MI. There's a higher rate with people that are smoking dye. There's a higher rate of fractures. It causes osteoporosis. I mean, it just goes on, and yet we're getting more ubiquitous use of marijuana, which it'll be like alcohol one of these days, if it's not already. It's just a crazy paradigm shift that it's, when we have the most evidence that it's bad, we're legalizing it. So in that light, some people was asking me, are there differences? I know that you when we had a talk at one point, cocaine has a different MO with regard to those people tend to be more sexually addicted and things like that. And are there different recovery rates for heroin, crystal meth, cocaine,
pot, yeah, alcohol? On the brain chemistry, there is, you know, differences there. I mean, with people with amphetamines or speed or cocaine, you know, the stimulants, you know, you're going to see a lot more, you know, sexual stuff occurring. I mean, they'll go and become like rabbits, so to speak, you know, but with the downers, the opiates and stuff like that, is, man, you're going to lose, you know, a lot of your sex drive. And so, yes, you're going to address, you know, some of that's dual also, as you're dealing with sex addiction on top of the, chemical addiction. But, I don't think there's that much when it comes to differences, unless you're talking about a treatment center and stuff like that. But I think the brain and the development of the brain, it depends on, you know, how long the person's been using and if it's just alcohol versus, you know, marijuana or opiates or stuff like that is, you know, it takes a while. It takes a while for all these guys to clear their head. You know, alcohol, you know, is probably one of the most powerful drugs to come off of when your body needs it to survive. It's worse than heroin, and most people don't realize that. You need to be medically detoxed, and if you're not medically detoxed and you're just taken off of it, you will probably die. But with heroin, you can throw them into, you know, a box, you know, that's nice and padded, and give them a bucket, and, you know, after 3 or 4 days, they'll be detoxed.
Yeah. Right. That's a true statement. When I was at Parkland on the wards, I mean, you can't, those people will die if you don't medically detox alcoholics when they're that far along. So, and people don't realize it. They think alcohol is not that way, but it's probably the hardest to come off.
It is. Yeah, but a lot of people don't get to that place by the time they show up in treatment. You know, I was young, I didn't get to that place, but people, when they're starting to go through DTs on a daily basis and stuff like that, you know. So, yeah.
Do you have anybody who's passing stuff to the side if you have a question? We're just about, we're getting up against the time he has to go watch the basketball game. So,
yeah. And we can end with go Spurs, go.
Yeah. 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 So, one of the things, again, that, I guess this is what the ministry's, here for is to process, help people process how to make decisions. Chico, we tell people we don't give you direction, but we give you direction. We don't give you direction specifics on your own child because you know them better, but we give you biblical principles, and they're consistent with 12-step. Sometimes people, you know, I go out there and I hear these TED Talks, and it's mostly the secular world that talks about, you know, forget everything you knew about addiction, 12-step is a failure, love them, spend the money on resources, and they talk about countries that have done that and succeeded. You know, I get back to whether the Bible is reliable. It clearly is. It supports the 12-step program. What do you say to people who debunk that whole approach?
Well, I like that. There's a lot more. Dr. Kelly out of Harvard really, really talks about the 12 steps as a medicine of success, you know, and defines it from that medical model, you know, and he has a lot of good stuff. You know, Kevin McCauley has, you know, he has a great video. It's kind of slow at first, but at the end, it's powerful. And he was a medical doctor. He can't practice medicine anymore. He worked in the military and got thrown in Leavenworth, and he shares that, you know, but Kevin McCauley's video, I'll remember it before we leave, is powerful too, you know, supporting, you know, the 12 steps and how the 12 steps are successful. What the 12 steps are, it's, you know, getting out of self, you know, just like what scripture's saying is, man, you know, scripture's saying we need to die to self. You know, Christ talks about that. You know, the 12 steps kind of say the same thing. You know, we need to die to self. That is, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems. You know, and you know, Christ talks about that. It's throughout the Old Testament, New Testament, how we need to get out of the way, you know, and surrender ourselves. This ministry, you know, Ephesians 4, speak the truth in love. Sometimes love isn't pretty and nice and sweet. You know, I like Ephesians 4 also. It says, be angry yet do not sin. But it's all right to be angry at the disease. It's all right to be angry at them running on self-will. If it's, you know, through manipulation with adoption or not taking their meds, it's all right to be angry. Just don't sin in your anger. You know, speak the truth in love. Quit tiptoeing around. You know, call them out, you know, on those behaviors. Be open to being called out yourself, because they'll turn it back. Own it if you're manipulating them. Because we become manipulators when we're trying to control our kids. You know, recognize that. But we can justify it too. You know, be aware of that. You know, be aware that we will manipulate, just, you know, sometimes even more, and it looks prettier. We get dressed up, have a nice yellow tie, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So this is for you. When you were caught up in your addictions and seeking pleasure yourself, I think this is for you. I hope it's not for me. was the love of your family, did you feel that as pressure? And do you think it was best for you to hear they loved you? I mean, this is an honest question from the floor.
Yeah, I haven't thought of it. Do I think I felt it was good? You know, my deal is that my mom would tell me she loves me. My dad But I wasn't at a place to even be loved. It was good. I think, you know, they continued to plant seeds, and it was real powerful in that regard. But I would use that and manipulate that. It wasn't until I'm grateful, you know, my last drunk was getting arrested, you know, in Austin, Texas. And then where they really loved me is they didn't bail me out of jail, and my friends didn't either. That was the best love they did to me.
Yeah, you know, in that documentary, it was a powerful moment when they, you know, the thing that we can't do here, right, is we don't know your kids. And so to see the path they're on while you're on this path, but it showed that y'all could do that because you had a recovery environment as well as for both the parents and the kids. And there was one time where the kid was acknowledging that when the mom was sitting there weeping and crying, remembering the moment, she said, no. And this kid, now that he's recovered, looks back on that and said, that may be one of the most courageous things I've ever seen anybody do, now that I know what that love looks like and letting me go and those kind of things. And
yeah, so, when Caleb was in the first treatment center, and he was manipulating, saying, I'm going to kill myself, you know, and you know, his mom goes, okay, you know, if you do that, I will be really sad. You know, and she held a boundary, and that was really loving when she said no. Right. So, you know, yes, they told me they love me, but the best thing is holding me accountable, not letting me manipulate. There's a few people in here, you know, Rick and Catherine saw me in my drinking. I would come up to Austin and be obnoxious, you know, little high schooler, you know, but and I was fun too. I mean, am I right? Yeah. I mean, I could see, honestly,
I've never said this, but I could see you as fun and really see you as obnoxious too.
Yes, so, yeah. I mean, all at the same time.
Yeah. So we're going to close with this one, but because we could go on all night, and we'll carry this out in our close group. But this person said, I know the answer to this, but I'm going to go on. He says, do you suggest that you make your someone do rehab, or should it be their idea if they're over 18? Secondly, you can't make them do rehab if they're over 18. So I know the answer to that question. However, I was with a couple last night, great godly couple, came down, said, hey, look, can we come down and talk to you and Jenny? And basically they got a kid that's 16, you know, and not totally off the rails, but lying. You know, you don't know where that goes, right? You know, we have kids that are doing things, and sometimes it turns out well, and sometimes it doesn't. And the thing that keeps me up at night, this is more of a parenting and a prodigal question, is that last 2 years there. So they got 2 years left before their kids go. They're 18. And what gets me, you're talking about, well, I'm going to, you know, we could set the boundaries, whatever. And I've really come full circle on this, because there's a fine line, right, between setting boundaries and making sure you prevent them from temptation. Or what gets me is 80% of Christian kids that leave out here just implode. And you put so much restriction on them that they're just ready to get out of the gate and they go try everything. So that's a fine line in terms of the community and how we nurture those people. I said, look, here's what I told them. Look for every opportunity to let them fail before they leave the house, so they realize that the ways that seem right to them will lead to death. I don't know what each one of those look like, but I think processing it in the closed groups back here with counselors like Chico, you know, I've gone and asked him these same questions with regard to what does this look like? What should we do in these situations? And you give us practical ideas, but you want to comment on those last couple of 3 years? I mean, you're going to face that with your girls, right?
I'm facing that right now. And especially talking to parent groups and stuff, I've said this for a long time, but I have a 17, he'll be 18 next month. And I have a 13-year-old. You know, I always say, hey, Shannon and I are saving for college and rehab just because of the gene pool, you know. And Larry knows my kid. My oldest son is, you know, a parent's dream. You know, that doesn't mean that he's not going to struggle with this. I recognize what you're saying. I mean, he's straight A student. He's already gotten an offer as a junior to West Point to play football. He's gotten a couple other offers. You know, I mean, he loves Jesus. You know, he doesn't drink, he doesn't drug. His friends tell us that. I mean, he's known for that. Then I have my 13-year-old. The day my son got the offer to West Point, he was told to run around the school with his athletic, you know, athletic class, and he's mooning the class, you know. And then this week, they had Stars last week, and we get called in because they're watching a movie after Stars, and he has his hand on this girl's leg. You know, yes, he might go down that road, but also Travis might go down. We have to continue what Proverbs talks about. Train your kids in the way of the Lord, and they shall not depart. That doesn't mean they won't. But I'm called to do what I'm supposed to do. But back to that question, we can't make someone go to treatment, but you can make it pretty interesting, you know, by setting those boundaries and those consequences and say, hey, we will support you here, but we're not going to support you anywhere else. You know, and if you want our help, you know, it's down at this program at such and such place. And that's the only place you're going to even get any kind of support. And they actually provide food and a place to sleep.
Well, that's exactly what we did with our son. And we said that we're going to support you here and not. And if you get off the Greyhound bus at 9:30 tomorrow morning, there's $80. And if you're there, we'll send you to Wilderness. And so we went down there not knowing if he'd get off the bus. And he got off the bus. So we sent him to Wilderness. And we're still on that path. But anyway, Chico, thanks for your time. We could go on all night. And we hope to have him back. And we'll have these resources for you. We're always trying to process resources for you. I hope that if it wasn't just addiction tonight, it was... We talked about addiction tonight. We also have LGBTQ problems, and we have all kinds of issues here and spouses. But I think the applications apply to everyone. And I'm going to pray for...
Can I pray for y'all?
Please.
Yeah. Thank you. Lord, I thank you for Jay and his leadership and the other leaders, Larry and Kay, that are here just taking their time, sharing their heart, being vulnerable, Lord. I ask that it opens up the doors for other families that are struggling and the struggles that they face with their kids, Lord. I ask that you continue to refine each of us in this room. You are calling each of us, you know, to love you, to trust you, to rest on you, Lord. Lord, I ask that you protect, the leaders, to give them strength to continue to persevere. Lord, I think about, I'm gonna name them the Freeman family losing a second son in 3 months from heroin addiction. Lord, I ask that you comfort them to give them hope in you, Lord, and you alone, Lord. I think about the older brother who found his second brother in the last 3 months. That you protect him as he has struggled with this disease, Lord. I thank you for each person in here this evening, and thank you for the opportunity just to come up and spend time with Jay. Amen.